the more we can understand and see and picture and realize that the Bible's talking about real history, real stuff that really happened. It's not just stories. And so when there are points in the Bible where we can really point to that in helpful ways, it helps us understand. We're talking about the... This isn't a little... I didn't mean this pun initially. The hand of God in history. That's what this is, really. The hand of God in real human history. It's also faith building in the reliability of the Bible in this particular instance. It's remarkable. So let's talk about the historical setting of Daniel 5. Just quick one background thing to understand about this. So you understand that the Old Testament tells us about a period of history that reaches back into prehistory, before written languages, before we have archaeological remains from these places. The Bible tells us about things that are prehistory, human, in terms of other human sources. But then as the Old Testament continues, we start to get more and more and more stuff. More and more cultures developed written languages. We have more things that survived that archaeologists find. So the later you get in the Old Testament, the more likely it is that we have extra biblical writings and cultural artifacts, you know, the stuff archaeologists find, that we can look at in comparison to what the Bible says. So by the time you get to the story of the Old Testament continues until about 450 BC. Daniel 5 is, you know, roughly 100 years before that. So by that point, we start to have several different historical sources. Not all of them are very reliable, but archaeologists have more stuff they've found. So that's part of the reason why a place like Daniel 5, we have more to talk about. So first of all, remember that two ancient historical sources give us the exact date of when Babylon fell, and that is October 12th, 539. There it is. So that means this big party in Daniel 5 was either on October 12th or it was the night before on October 11th. So kind of amazing that we know that date from 540 years or so before Jesus was born. So let's put this on a timeline. On the left end of our timeline, we have King David and roughly the beginning of the Jewish monarchy, obviously Saul right before him. But the reason why I started there is because that's really where you have the Jewish people, although it wasn't good for them to ask for a king, at that point you can think of them more like modern nations. They've got their own place, and they've got their own rule, and they're a self-ruling nation. But then Daniel chapter 1, 605 BC, that comes to an end. I mean, the Jewish monarchy is over. You've just got puppets for a few years and then gone. And so that's Daniel 1, 605 BC. And then, so Daniel 5 takes place in 539 BC, like we just said, this party of Belshazzar's. So if we zoom in now on this, so 605, the Babylonian captivity began, Daniel chapter 1, and then there's kind of like three different stages in which the Babylonians came and took Jews and increasingly destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. So that's from 605 to 586 BC, and then in 562, Nebuchadnezzar dies, and starting at that point, it's just one mess after another. And there are assassinations, and there are bad rulers, and there are plots, and they're almost all like relatives of Nebuchadnezzar in one way or another, but Babylon just falls apart in those 20-some years before the party in Daniel chapter 5, and then you get about a year later, Cyrus apparently makes his proclamation that the Jews can return to the land, and so that process starts to happen over the next few years after 538. Okay, are we good with that? So, let's get to a series of questions now. First of all, how old was Daniel in chapter 5 when Belshazzar had this party? And what was he doing at this time? So, how old was he? Back to our timeline. So, I know there's a lot up here, but 539, Daniel chapter 5 is over here, right? And you see there it says he was about 80. Why would we say he's 80? Well, he was old enough in 605 to come to Babylon and go to Babylon Palace High School. So we're guessing he was somewhere around 13, 14, 15, 16 in 605. And so if he was born somewhere around 620, then he's in his early 80s in 539. He's maybe, you know, 81, 82, 83. And we don't know when he died. We just know that he, remember the last verse of Daniel 1 tells us that he was in government. He was there until the first year of Cyrus. So we don't know exactly when he died, but we know that he continued into the Persian administration here in his early 80s. So he was old. What was he doing? So two things. First of all, that last verse of Daniel 1 says he was there, which seems to mean in the palace, in the government, until the first year of Cyrus. So apparently he continued in some kind of government role. And there's actually a verse in Daniel 8 that tells us he was doing the king's business when Belshazzar was king, at least early on when Belshazzar was king. So best guess is that over the years, as after Nebuchadnezzar died, as you go along this part of the timeline, Daniel gets older, the government falls apart, they don't even remember who Daniel is. He stayed in government roles, but they got smaller and smaller and smaller in their significance. So probably in Daniel chapter 5, he's some kind of very minor government official in the Babylonian government. All right, since we're looking at timelines, and I promise you we're almost done with timelines, if you don't like timelines. Since we're looking at timelines, let's talk about Jeremiah's 70 years for just a minute. Now, we're going to come back and talk about this a lot more later. I just want to mention it to you now while we're looking at timelines. So three verses to note. Jeremiah 25, 12. Here's what Jeremiah said, what God said through Jeremiah. After 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation. Ezra says, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation. And in Daniel chapter 9, I, Daniel, perceived in the books the number of years that according to the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet must pass before the end of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. So we'll talk more about this in detail later on, but basically God promised that there was going to be about a 70-year time frame for the Babylonian captivity. And so how many years has it been since that? Let's go to the next slide. How many years has it been since Daniel was taken into captivity? Mental math. How many years in 539? Steve had it before I even asked the question. The king of mental math. 66, right? Something like 66 years when Belshazzar has the party. So there's disagreement about exactly when the 70 years starts and exactly when the 70 years ends. But the basic point is when Babylon falls initially to the Persians in 605, the clock is ticking on God's time frame and just what God said was going to happen. He said that Babylon would fall and that the captivity would end as it did through Cyrus. So that reminds us that the events of world history are more than they appear. I know it's a little cliche to say it, but it's also good to say it. History is his story. It is the playing out of the purposes and plans of God despite the sin of men. Okay? All right, now, couple more things before we get to the pictures. But next, I'm going to talk about pineapples, so that's interesting. Was Belshazzar really the last king of Babylon? So Daniel chapter 5, verse 1, talks about Belshazzar as the king, and then he's the one who dies as the last king of Babylon. Now, here's what's really interesting about this. If you lived 100 years before the time of Jesus, or at the time of Jesus, or in the year AD 500 or 1000 or 1500, and you went and tried to find out any information about this King Belshazzar, there was none anywhere. No mention of him at all. And so what do you think people who don't want to believe the Bible is the Word of God did with that? Well, I found a quote for you. I think it's up here. This is from 1894, which this guy's behind the times, but he should have known better by 1894. Here's what he says. When Daniel gives the name and parentage of the last king of Babylon as Belshazzar, son of Nebuchadnezzar, history flatly contradicts him, because history said that the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. So he says, this is a blunder, which alone is enough to ruin our faith in the historical character of his story. A blunder as damaging as if somebody from London came to North America in a pine forest, and he wrote home, he were to inform his readers in a note that during his first week there, he gathered pineapples every morning for his breakfast. So kids, how many of you have been to the forest? How many of you have gathered pineapples off the forest floor for breakfast? It doesn't happen, right? So he's saying whoever wrote the book of Daniel made it up just as much as somebody who says he gets pineapples off the forest floor for Daniel, because everybody knows Belshazzar wasn't the last king of Babylon. Well, the thing is, in the late 1800s, they started to discover a number of ancient Babylonian clay tablets, which are called the Babylonian Chronicles. This is one of the most famous of them. This is called the Nabonidus Chronicle. You've probably also seen pictures of the Cyrus Cylinder, but this one is from Nabonidus. And lo and behold, it turns out that someone named Belshazzar is talked about in 37 different places in the Babylonian Chronicles. And it turns out that King Nabonidus, who was king of Babylon, had a particular god that he served, ironically, the god S-I-N, Sin. And the religious leadership in Babylon, who were very devoted to Marduk, saw Nabonidus and his love for Sin as a big problem. And so he actually left town, went 500 miles south down into the Arabian Peninsula, and for the majority of Nabonidus's reign, he was on this kind of religious pilgrimage in the middle of nowhere. And he appointed his son Belshazzar, it says, as co-regent. And Belshazzar ruled Babylon because the honorary king was nowhere to be seen. So if you lived in Babylon at the time of Daniel, who would you say was the king of Babylon? The guy who's in Babylon as co-regent ruling the empire, Belshazzar. That's what we found in the Babylonian Chronicles after, for the last 2,000 years, there hadn't been an existing mention of Belshazzar. And then we got 37 of them. One of the fun little twists in that story is that it makes it really difficult for the people who try to say that Daniel was written in the 160s BC, you know, because they say he has to have, it can't be prophecy, you know, he has to know this stuff. It's hard for them to figure out how he knew about Belshazzar. Because from everything we know, Belshazzar had been lost to historical memory by the 160s. All the records said Nabonidus was the last king. So it's funny because the liberals say, I just read a quote from one of them who says, we will never know how the author of Daniel knew about Belshazzar. Maybe because he lived there, not 400 years later. Okay, let's turn our attention now. Oh, by the way, this also helps us understand something else peculiar in the story. Do you remember what he offered, what Belshazzar offered as rewards? What was the very best position he could offer? Third. Why is that? Because he was actually second, though he was the one ruling. Okay, so let's turn our attention now to some things related to Babylon's party itself. Any questions about that timeline stuff, pineapples, anything? Yes, Xander. No. No. There were no pineapples off the floor. Though whether Belshazzar had pineapples is something we don't know. Somebody probably knows that, but I don't.
Did he have pineapples?
Do what?
Did he even have pineapples?
I don't know. That is a good question. Someone needs to look that up for us. Were there pineapples in ancient Babylon? Google might help us. Hey, Siri. Were there pineapples in ancient Babylon? Antiquity of the pineapple in America. List of pineapple appearances. Okay, anyways. All right, let's move on to Belshazzar's party. All right, the location of Belshazzar's party. Take your Bible and go to Daniel 5. All right, Daniel chapter 5, and we are going to read verses 1 and 5. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. That's verse 1. Now look at verse 5. Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. All right, so we need a room in the city of Babylon with plastered walls, and we need the room to be large enough for 1,000 people. Beginning in the year 1900, a German archaeologist led the excavations of the ruins of central ancient Babylon. 200 people or more worked 7 days a week for 15 years on that excavation of Babylon. It was an incredible undertaking. And they found the incredible walls that surrounded the city. They found the Ishtar Gate, which I'll show you in a little bit. They found temples. They found a bunch of cellars that might have been underneath the hanging gardens. And they also found the complex where the different palaces had been joined together into one giant palace compound in ancient Babylon. So from those ruins, they have been able to figure out a tremendous amount about what was there in the time of Daniel and what it would have been like. And so I want to share a little bit of that with you. I'm certainly no archaeologist, and I haven't taken like classes in, you know, ancient Babylon or something. So I'm sure I won't get everything right in what I'm sharing with you now. You're welcome to do your own research, but I'll try to give you a quick overview. So I think this is the most helpful picture to begin with. This is not, of course, the ruins themselves. This is a reconstruction of the ruins that's in modern day Babylon, and they're trying to protect it despite all the war and stuff there. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site now. This is a reconstruction based on the ruins that they found. And off on the sides, you have all sorts of storage rooms and kitchens and bedrooms and all kinds of things. Of course, we're missing the roof over all that, right? There's no roof. There would have been. These are open courtyards here and here and back here. But this would have all been covered with roofs. And so then you can see large gates coming into large courtyards, and this big central courtyard, which has a large doorway, which leads into this room right here, which is almost certainly the room where Belshazzar had his party. Now, that room might not look big enough for a party for 1,000 people, but to get size perspective, can you picture the White House for me? Now, the White House is not gigantic, but it's a whole lot bigger than our houses, right? You could take the White House and set it in that room. It's just about the same size. So that's a big room. You could have a lot of people there for a party. And a little more size perspective, check out this look up at those walls from ground level. They are ginormous. is the official measurement of them. And then, do you see these gates? How big are those gates? Well, let's back up for a second. Here is a satellite view of this area of Babylon. Now, by the way, over there on the left is, and you can't see it because we're not in three dimensions here, but that's up on a big hill, is the palace that Saddam Hussein built for himself. And again, I haven't researched this a lot, but apparently he could have cared less about the fact that he built his palace on top of all these ancient ruins. He just flattened them and didn't care and built himself this huge palace overlooking that. So I don't think anybody knows what's underneath that, what's underneath that big hill he built for himself and his palace. Rumor has it that at one point he wanted to build like a what do you call it? You know, like a sky tram kind of thing that went from his palace down over all that and down to the road, and somebody successfully vetoed Saddam Hussein. I don't know how that happened. Anyways, so the picture we were looking at just a minute ago, the picture before, can you go back to it for just a second? Yeah, this picture. Okay, now go back ahead. Is from this, you know, like the arrow right over here, looking that direction. Does that make sense? And so can you find the big room? You see the big room right there? And see here are these courtyards? And you got these big gates. All right, now, let's go to the next slide. Yeah, there's the party room. And here's the gates. Now look, there's actually a gate out here. And there's a long corridor that comes down. And then you go through this big main gate. And then you come down and you go through this gate and then through this gate and then through this gate. And now you're getting into the kind of central palace area there. So this gate out here is really famous. It's the Ishtar Gate. And they found all these crumbled pieces of it in the early 1900s. And they took them back to Berlin and they reconstructed what the Ishtar Gate looked like. Here it is in a museum in Berlin. Look at the size of that thing. So now you get some size perspective on all that was going on in that palace. But also, look at that tile work. Just in case you thought it was all like drab, boring brown, this was incredible stuff they were doing. This panel over here, they also discovered. And so probably that panel is a sample of something they had on lots of walls, like repeating of that panel. So this is like glazed tile. These are gods, depictions of gods that are here on that tile. Isn't that incredible? So if you want to know the kind of hard work that goes into this kind of reconstruction, here's a picture of the archaeologists working. This is the kind of stuff they had to work with. It's just rubble. It had just been smashed. And they took thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of rubble and tried to figure out what goes together and what was there. It's pretty. I do not want to be an archaeologist. It does not appeal to me at all, but I'm thankful for the people who are. So here's more of that tile work. And so this would have been, remember that long passageway to get to the Ishtar Gate? These panels were like, I don't know, like 8 feet high or something, running all along that passageway with all of these lions. And actually, if you look up like pictures from ancient Babylon, one of the first things you'll see is this big lion statue that still remains there near those ruins. So can you imagine the color of that stuff when it was brand new, you know, there? You start to get a little bit of a taste of Nebuchadnezzar's glory. And also, when you see how big that palace compound was, you start to get a little bit of a taste of why Belshazzar felt impenetrable. Because not only do you have that massive palace in that city, but outside on the edges of it, they had incredible walls. Now, the historical sources give widely varying numbers about those walls. But think in terms of 20 feet wide by 60 feet tall. Now, some of the numbers say they were much bigger than that. But just 20 by 60 is quite a wall, right? And some sections of that were double walls. This was a very impressively well-guarded city and a beautiful city. So I know, Lincoln, I've gotten totally off script here. What's the next slide? Oh, yeah, there we go. Okay, so here's that like processional way up to the Ishtar gate. Can you see running along the edges? See where those lion panels were? And then they've got the tile work at the top of these all along here and then leading up to that gate. And then it was a whole sequence of gates back into the middle of the palace and where the party would have been. Okay, next slide. Yeah, here's a, you know, some of this is guessing, but a lot of this is based on stuff they've found. There are several different artist reconstructions of what this might have been like. So here you come down that processional through the Ishtar gate, and then you'd come down here and you'd make a right turn and start into that sequence. See right here is what we were looking at? Gate, courtyard, gate, courtyard, and then the room would have been back in there. The big party room would have been back behind that. Now notice, what's this? What's interesting about this? And this, and this. What's interesting? Material, it's white, right? So they've found this white plaster material that was used in the palace. What did Daniel 5 verse 5 say? What does it say? That the hand wrote on the plaster. They've found it. That's why you have all this white on here. Because they know that this white plaster was used on the walls and that it was used in that room, on the walls in that room. And you can see how in a world of drab brown, white walls would have been really impressive. And when you put white walls together with that blue tile and gold tile, it was really impressive visually. So that's all pretty cool. Okay, let's go back to the room itself now. What do you notice? Anything you notice about that room? I know we can't see it very well from here, but what's the most obvious feature? Yes, Hazley?
No windows.
That's true. Yes, Journey? Right, that's because this is just kind of like a model they built really cheaply. Remember, Iraq has had lots of war and bad governments and all that. So this is just kind of like a cheaply built, cheap brick model. But it doesn't have any of the beautiful tile or plaster or anything like that on it. That's a good observation. Yes. And why would there not be any windows? Arthur? Yeah, privacy. I think the biggest reason is that there was no glass and it's the desert. And so if you have open windows and you get sandstorms and stuff, you know, bye-bye palace. I mean, it's just going to be an absolute disaster. So it was a world where you were either outside or you were closed in inside, but you didn't like open up your blinds to the world. So what else do you notice? Yeah, I think so. I think this is actually a door, but look closely at this. Is that a door? Ooh, good guess. Is that for an idol? How about if we go look inside the room, huh? There we go. Now we're in it. Ah, that's what that thing was that you were seeing. It's not quite a door, is it, Titus? So what do you think? What? You got it. Exactly right. That's got to be, that whole thing is like a place for the king to sit. Right? So now we know where Belshazzar was. He was right, surely right there in front of that thing. Yes, ma'am? Uh-huh. They're really thick walls. Mm-hmm. And probably these are like lots of like storage rooms and places for the servants to have all the food and all the stuff they need to go get so they can bring it really fast to the party. Yeah, good. Okay. So we see that, but now remember, we've got to imagine this with tile work and plaster. And the ceiling, they say, was cedar, which must have been pretty awesome. A ceiling that big out of cedar. The doors were cedar. Cedar's a really pretty wood that grew up in Lebanon close to Israel. And so the kings liked to have them put it on ships and bring it down the Mediterranean Sea and then make boards out of it for their palaces because it was so pretty. The cedars of Lebanon are kind of famous. So it was a really pretty wood. So the ceilings were cedar, the doors were cedar, and then the door accents were like bronze. So you had metal accents all over the room as well. So this was a pretty cool room. Yes, sir.
Uh-huh.
That's true. I think that's probably just accidental, but still a good observation. Yeah. Okay, so let's go to one more picture here. And so here's kind of a, you know, obviously super wide angle camera lens here, but now you can see the doors on both sides and you can see that center. And I don't know if that platform's original. I don't know if they have evidence of that, that would have been there or not. It makes sense that it would have been there. And so you read Daniel 5 verse 1. He drank wine in front of the thousand, and you can kind of picture him up there, right? Actually, we can start to kind of picture the whole scene at that party. So take this, boring brick walls, and glamorize it like an emperor would do, and get your sparkling white walls and your brilliant colored tiles and your cedar ceiling and your shining bronze accents on everything and all the food and wine that you want. And Belshazzar's up there on the platform and everybody's watching him drink and his wives and concubines are probably all around him there. And then you've got, you know, another 800 more lords. And I don't know if it was lords and ladies or just lords there, important people in his kingdom. And everybody's drinking and everybody's partying. And remember what they're drinking out of? What were they using? Nope, not their hands. What were they drinking out of? Kids, do you know, despite the fact you've been in children's church, not down here? Yes, ma'am? Emma? You got it. They had gold cups from the Jewish temple. Why would they want to drink out of gold cups from the Jewish temple?
Because they didn't have any more cups and all they had was gold.
Well, that would be an interesting answer. But there's a better answer. Anybody else know why they drank out of gold cups from the Jewish temple? Yes, Josiah. Do you have a guess? For respect? It should have been, right? So they were actually doing it kind of the opposite of that. They were doing it because they didn't believe in the true God. They didn't believe in the God of the Bible. And they wanted to kind of make fun of him and show that they didn't believe in him and show that they could do whatever he wanted and they couldn't stop him. So can you picture the party? And you picture them with those things. Now, what does it say about the handwriting on the wall in verse 5? The phrase there in verse 5 makes it sound like that it was in the light in the wall from the lampstand. I know the ESV uses the word opposite. Most translations don't translate it that way. I think, so first of all, there's no electricity, right? So to light a room that big, they must have had some giant lampstands that held like torches, like a number of torches. So if you can imagine a big white wall like this, and we put fairly close to it a huge lampstand with huge torches. First of all, it's going to reflect off that wall and light the room for us. And second of all, it's going to create this giant, like, spotlight effect on that wall behind the lantern. And so it seems like this hand from God appeared right there in that spotlight on one of the walls. So, you know, when I look at this, I picture it right in the middle of one of those blank walls. Right? You can kind of easily picture that between the door and the center. Now, probably, though, it wasn't. Why? because Belshazzar saw it right. So it's more likely it was on an end or across from him than that it was kind of on the walls right beside him. But it still helps me to picture giant, floor lamp kind of things sitting there with these big torches on them, lighting up this room, creating this big spotlight on the white wall, and then the hand that suddenly appeared there. And yes? Well, those doors led back to all those little rooms and hallways because that's where all the kitchen people would be because they had to feed 1,000 people and get them all their drinks and everything. So that was for all the servants to have all their stuff to be ready to come and serve the party. Probably. They probably had lots of big kitchens, record-setting number of ovens, I imagine. Okay, so that hand comes, and the party in that room was over. And as a matter of fact, the Babylonian Empire's use of this entire palace was over forever. That was it. That whole compound, the Persians took it. And so this night was the end of all their glory, all their partying, all their beauty, all their fun, everything Nebuchadnezzar had worked so hard for, gone and handed over to somebody else. By the way, we don't have time to get into all of it today, but there are numerous ancient accounts of the fall of Babylon. And again, they're more or less trustworthy. But one of them, Xenophon, who was a Greek historian and writer in the 400s BC, he is the one who describes the way that the Persians were able to breach the city. You've probably heard about this, but I wanted to show you the quote itself from Xenophon. Here's what he writes. At last, the ditches were completed. Then when that's Cyrus II, when Cyrus heard that a certain festival had come round in Babylon, during which all Babylon was accustomed to drink and revel all night long, Cyrus took a large number of men just as soon as it was dark and opened up the heads of the trenches at the river. So apparently he had his soldiers dig these canals. And then when he gave the signal, they opened up the end of those canals to connect them to the river, and they diverted water from the river. As soon as that was done, the water flowed down through the ditches in the night, and the bed of the river where it traversed the city became passable for men. What river is that? It goes right through the middle of Babylon. It's the Euphrates. And so Xenophon, if we can trust what Xenophon is telling us in the 400s, he's saying that the way Cyrus did this is they actually diverted the Euphrates River, which went right through town, which to Belshazzar would have been a means of security. It means we've got water. But it ended up maybe being their downfall if Xenophon has his story correct. So very interesting. And by the way, same source, Xenophon goes on to say that that night the Persians celebrated because they killed that wicked king. Now, it doesn't give his name, but it describes them taking Babylon basically without a battle, but killing the king because of his wickedness, which is pretty fascinating in light of what Daniel 5 tells us. All right, let's move on to a couple of other things. These are a little more miscellaneous, but I don't want to fail to talk about them before we leave Daniel 5. Why couldn't they read the handwriting on the wall? Daniel 5, verse 8 says, "Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation." Well, how can it be that they couldn't read the writing? Well, first of all, remember that it wasn't actually a sentence. It was just 4 seemingly random words with one of them repeated twice. So it was actually a riddle. It wasn't a sentence. It was just 4 words, and you had to try to figure out what the relationship was. But also, because it was Aramaic, it would have almost certainly been written just as a sequence of unseparated consonants without spaces between the words and without vowel markings down below the letters. Hebrew and Aramaic are the same letters, so this is Hebrew. But there's no exact parallel in English, but it might be a little bit like this. What does that say? And this is actually a sentence. This is a sentence, and it wasn't a sentence. It was just 4 random words, so I'm being nice here with this one. What does that say? Well, the reality is that could say a lot of things. Once we separate that into words and put vowels in, this could say a lot of things. What I wrote was the fat dog ate food. But we could probably come up with several other things that it meant. When I took Hebrew, and some of you have heard me tell this story, but there's a famous quiz in Hebrew class in which they give you a paragraph of the Hebrew Old Testament, but they don't tell you what book of the Bible it's from. You don't have the reference. You just have a paragraph. And Hebrew, like this, is just it's just a whole bunch of letters. Now, there is, it's hard to explain. But bottom line is, you start into those letters and with no context. So when the hand wrote on the wall, did they have any idea what it was about? Right? No context at all. Okay? When they gave us that paragraph in Hebrew with no context, we all started working and we started translating that into a sentence. But it wasn't. It was a genealogy. It was a list of names. But it took us, depending on how smart the student was, 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 minutes to figure out it was a genealogy, because you could find lots of other words in there. And so we were trying to create sentences and figure out what this meant. And then you would see it dawn on one student at a time. This is a list of names. Now, once you knew that, it wasn't too hard to translate. But until then, it was pretty humorous for the teacher to sit there and watch us. So the bottom line is, when they looked up at that wall and that hand wrote a series of Aramaic consonants that was just four words that were like a riddle with no context, it was extremely challenging. And so it's not a surprise that they weren't able to figure it out. All right, one last thing. We have 2 minutes. Who was the queen who came in? So that's down in verse 10. Let's read it. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him." Look at verse 12, the end of the verse. She calls him Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. So first of all, scholars are almost completely unified in saying that this has got to be a queen mother or grandmother. His wives were already at the party. The Aramaic word can refer to the queen mother, not just the queen. So all the people smarter than me say this is almost surely either Belshazzar's mom or his grandmother. And the way the family works, that means either Nebuchadnezzar's daughter or wife. Now, we're talking about a woman who seems to know more about Babylon's history. She seems to be older. She seems to think very highly of Daniel. And she says there at the end of verse 12, he will tell you the interpretation. She is certain Daniel will do it. And what does she call him? She insists on calling him by his Jewish name, Daniel, instead of calling him Belteshazzar. So who is this woman who knows a lot of Babylonian history back to Nebuchadnezzar, thinks very highly of Daniel, seems to respect Daniel, call him by his Jewish name, and is certain Daniel's going to know what this interpretation is? Well, we can't prove who she is. I mean, we know some of the women in this family tree. We can make some guesses. But it is not unreasonable at all for us to guess that either Nebuchadnezzar's wife or Nebuchadnezzar's daughter turned her heart to the true God through what Nebuchadnezzar went through. In other words, God's grace didn't just reach Nebuchadnezzar. It also reached his family, and here's evidence of it. Here, several decades later, maybe 40 years later or something like that, this could be Nebuchadnezzar's wife who comes in and says, "Belshazzar, you're a dummy. There's a true God, and he put his man right here in the kingdom, and you ought to know that, and you ought to get him in here because he's going to tell you what this is." So maybe God's grace rescued her too. It's a guess, but it's not like a wild guess. It's actually a very reasonable explanation of how this woman could exist and do what she just did. Because her father or husband had his heart broken and humbled by the true God and turned his heart to him and wrote Daniel chapter 4. Isn't that a cool part of the story? Okay. Yes, we should clap for Daniel chapter 5. That's right.